Let's try it and see what happens.
Cody, what do we say for your intro?
Make it up. Let it flow.
I'm Alex Lee.
And I'm Simona Capizani.
Welcome to A Hostile Climate. Simona, what are we doing today? We have a very special guest.
We have an exceptionally special guest today, our intrepid producer, the man that keeps Alex and I on track and is behind the scenes, Mr. Cody Nelson.
You know, if they listened to the credits of the last episode, they heard these golden pipes, so the real ones already know me.
We're breaking down the fourth wall here.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
That, I don't know if that exists in audio.
It's too intimate for the fourth wall.
Yeah, Cody, we're stoked to have you on mic.
I'm glad to be on our own podcast. So, reason I'm here today, I have some things that I'm thinking about, some climate stories that are either on my mind or particularly horrifying, and I'm not someone with a PhD in philosophy or someone who has studied environmental science at length, and so I wanted to just bring some of the stories of the last week or so, some things I've been thinking about, and just get your thoughts on them. Like, be my guide through this hostile climate, if you will.
We're going to get some hot takes.
Oh, God.
Amazing. That's all I want. And the first story I want to talk about is one that you sent to our group chat, Alex. The headline is, Timekeepers may subtract a second from clocks as soon as 2029 as the planet spins slightly faster.
I think I sent this to our podcast group chat with the note saying, no big deal, climate change just broke time.
Yeah, and you said that to me right before bed. So that was excellent. Thank you for the timing.
So, like, you got the text and then didn't sleep?
Yeah, basically.
Yeah.
I was in the Costco parking lot about to buy a bunch of, like, single-use plastics and things of that nature. So I was feeling, like, especially bleak about it. But, like, the gist of this story is the Earth's spin is changing because of melting polar ice caps. Basically, it's affecting the tides and causing the Earth to spin at a different rate. And by 2029, basically, clocks are going to have to skip a second, and this is called a negative leap second. And 1 second every year isn't necessarily a huge deal, but, like, to me, the way to read this is we are losing time to climate change, which just feels very dark.
It's really on the nose. Yeah. Like, it's a metaphor, and it's really happening, and it's just, yeah, really strikes a chord.
Yeah, it's weird because losing time, the Earth's rotation, right, is slowing down. So I guess to some extent, the ice caps melting is impacting the speed of the Earth's rotation. And I guess part of the thing that was keeping me up at night was that we think a lot, right, about these major impacts, systems failures, and things like that. And I just don't think anyone ever really conceptualizes, at least I didn't, like, the actual planet itself moving differently in space.
Yeah. The phenomena is really cool. Because, like, when I read it, I started thinking about interglacial periods over the last couple million years.
Yeah.
And, like, realizing that actually the rate of spin of the Earth on its axis is far from constant because of this phenomena.
Right.
Its variance is not huge, right? Seconds don't seem like a lot. The basic phenomena that is now being recognized is that we have a flow of mass from the Earth's poles to the equator. So as ice at the poles melts, that water moves from those high latitudes towards lower latitudes. And it's sort of equivalent to like a figure skater spreading their arms out. So if you can picture a figure skater spinning around, when their arms are tight together, they spin really fast. And when their arms get wider, they spin slower, right? As water flows towards the equator, it's slowing down the Earth because mass is moving further away. And we're going to have to account for that. And we've done that. We've actually changed the rate at which the Earth spins. I don't know why this seems like way bigger to me than most massive climate phenomena that we've come across lately.
Yeah. So there's like this slowing and there's this like shift. And now with this sort of like unprecedented, you know, this has just come out as a study, right? Like literally what this week, right? Because you sent it to us, and I think that report was
like yesterday. An astrophysical change.
Yeah, and that's what I mean. It
like changes Earth in the solar system.
Yes, and we know time is relative, but the fact that like within that length of a normal day, even if you don't notice it and you're not perceiving it, the very fact that it is automatically shortened,
yeah,
right, to some extent, that's what I guess kept me up at night a little bit, right? That kind of like stressing about it, like I was just saying before,
yeah.
I, you know, you always hear in the climate thing, like, well, humans may not be okay, or a bunch of species may not be okay, but the planet will survive. And, like, I always see that as a kind of, I don't know, I have, like, mixed feelings about that comment all the time. And, like, yeah, of course, fine, sure. I'm not worried about, like, planetary survival per se when I'm stressing out about climate change. But there is this element where, like, we are shifting, you know, the speed of rotation by something we've done. That's like an anthropogenic shift. Never before in human history did we alter the tilt or the speed of the Earth's rotation.
Yeah.
This is like a scale issue, right? Like, when is it significant enough that it elevates itself to something that's as significant as geological time shifts? I feel like it's like a very high level and a really high bar.
This seems like the biggest scale. I mean, like, sure, we could affect, you know, I don't know, we affect what's going on Jupiter, but it seems like we've hit sort of like maximal scale here, right? This phenomena is not like coastline variance or species decline, which has a sort of a patchwork. This is like the entire Earth spinning slower.
I don't know how much we want to get into us doing armchair geology and planetary physics and stuff, but like from elementary school, we do remember, right, like that the core of the Earth is like molten, right? Like it's liquid. So the reason why we're able to have some sort of an impact in this way, or why the ice melting having this kind of an impact, is also in part because we have a liquid core. And I just, there's, I don't know, N.K. Jemisin elements of like the Earth being its like alive liquid self, right? And that somehow being like intersecting with things that we're doing on the actual thin little bit of the crust, right, that impacts the entire thing. I know, that's what I was meaning from scale. I was like zooming all the way into the center of the planet and then all the way out in like a solar system perspective, and I think that's like the stress that was happening before bed when you sent the article.
Sure. I feel pretty out over my skis. Going too deep on
we'll,
that one
we'll then. Bring in the geophysicists later.
To try and bring this back to like something that doesn't require a great understanding of geophysics, what I'm hearing is like maybe the way to like think about this story is it's another reminder of the planet being this like it's not necessarily something that's going to live forever, quote unquote. It is this living being, and we can actually affect it in ways that seemed impossible. And maybe we knew this in terms of warming and like the causing the greenhouse effect, but like this is just a new level of like understanding that we can affect it on like an astronomical scale, I guess. This giant living being that is our home.
I mean, like as humans, we're really bad at understanding scale. We have this sort of relativism where we judge everything sort of according to our scale. We could think about this in terms of how we understand plants and animals, to how we understand change, to how we even understand our lives, right? Like, we care about things that are sort of at our scale. The smaller they get or the bigger they get, the harder it is to sort of wrap our heads around them, right? That happens on time scales that are really big or really small, and that happens on size scales that are really big or really small. It's really hard to grapple with things that are going to happen in the distant future or things that happen on really big scales. And so we tend to approach them with a kind of moral neglect. We sort of assume that like we can just kick them out of our consideration because they're just too hard to make sense of. And then, yeah, you end up with planetary scale problems.
This isn't a headline exactly, but I want to talk about climate politics in the U.S. And this isn't in response to a specific story, but just kind of a trend I've been worrying about, thinking about, just as we've inched ever closer to a rematch of 2020. Two old dudes who have already been president for 4 years apiece. I think a lot of people are pretty burnt out on just the talking points of this election, right? I mean, we didn't have meaningful primaries in either party. So there wasn't much like of the debate that you usually get during like a primary season, where I remember reporting on this in 2020 during the primaries for the Democratic Party. There was actual like meaningful discussion of like even local and regional level climate policies. And from my read as just like a consumer of this news and not an active political reporter anymore, it seems like all of the talk is about like Hunter Biden or whatever trial Donald Trump is going into. And there's not been a ton of discussion of climate politics on this like national level, despite the fact that we've had Joe Biden in office for 4 years. And a lot of people, I think, reasonably call him like the best climate president of all time. I'm seeing some reports that like Democratic strategists are worried that voters just aren't going to know about these climate accomplishments. It's just not factoring into the space at all. And this isn't like a philosophical question, but it's something that I did want to like bring to you two to just like help me make sense of.
I have two thoughts that immediately come to mind that I really am curious what both of you think of. So one, I think that unfortunately we're living in a time where there's a lot of issues that people are prioritizing above climate change. So there's a lot of issues that are just floating to the top of people's political priorities. There's a lot of one issue voters that, and climate change isn't it. And then the other thought I have on that is that while Biden has done a ton of work to address climate change, the political climate has been such that his administration and the Democrats at large have sort of had to hide it, right? The climate bill is called the Inflation Reduction Act.
Thanks, Joe Manchin.
We couldn't call it the climate bill, right? We like, it's the Inflation Reduction Act.
Did we fix inflation?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, we didn't. And like, arguably, it was a very clumsy tool to fix inflation in any meaningful way. But it did a lot to improve our infrastructure and address climate change, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think that across the board, climate wins have had to be hidden to make them more palatable. And people are prioritizing other things above climate. Now, at the same time, I actually think that there's more widespread agreement about climate change. And I actually think it's increasingly nonpartisan. And I don't know why that isn't a leverage.
Yeah, just bring up, as I was doing some research on this before I brought it to you two, there's a new CU Boulder report that basically suggests that climate politics is actually what swung the 2020 election in favor of Joe Biden. And a line in that report says that a quarter of Republicans who think climate change is, quote, very important, actually crossed party lines and voted for Biden over Donald Trump in 2020, which, I mean, it's not like a single issue voting thing, but, you know, that's proof to me that climate change is a sellable multi-partisan issue.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, the only other thing I wanted to say was, like, I think you're right. I think the problem is that so much political division has been sowed in America right now that while climate change is a very real existential threat, we're being told, like, both sides of the aisle are being told that there are other more pressing existential threats in front of them, right? Like, and this is, I'm not trying to like throw out a both sides-ism right now, but a narrative that I do see on both sides is that if the other guy wins, we're doomed, right? Trump is selling this narrative that if Biden wins again, that's the end of the country. And Biden is selling a narrative that if Trump wins, it's the end of democracy. Now, I might agree with one of those messages way more than I agree with the other, but it is this like narrative of political division that says the most pressing existential threat we face is the other guy, not these sort of bigger global collective actions and bigger, longer trends.
Yeah. So, yeah, I've got thoughts on kind of both these points because I think both these points are related. I actually don't necessarily think that the climate wins are, there's like a purpose in hiding. I don't think there's an intentional hiding in many cases. I'll get to why also why I don't think that's the case, or maybe why that should continue to not be the case. But to come back on your first point about messaging, that was kind of going to be the first thing I was going to say. Like you said at the beginning, Cody, it's a weird election because it feels like a rerun. And so in that respect, it's kind of unique because you have a case where the current president feels like they're running not as the incumbent. Right. So there's this kind of weird space where Biden wants to be able to run on his agenda, but like you're saying, Alex, is like constantly running as an oppositional candidate, is basically running on the basis, or at least up until recently, has kind of been running on the basis of a vote for me is a no vote for the other person, yeah, as a vote for me is, yes, a positive vote for this particular kind of vision. And this is actually where, like, I feel like I have some critiques, both from like a political theorist perspective and also maybe a strategy perspective, but I'm not being paid to be a Democratic strategist. But the idea is that, like, if you are able to offer a positive vision for the country and also talk about why, like, a win for Dems is then an opportunity to continue to build on the progress you've made, you're able to highlight and educate people on the actual progress that you've made with respect to climate. That's a huge part of that message, and why being able to vote for Democrats means we get, you know, IRA 2.0, or we actually get to build on many of the advances that the IRA put in place. Because as a kind of large-scale industrial policy, we are going to need time to see some of the impacts, and there's also more opportunities to address gaps that that huge bill wasn't able to address. I think there should be a more positive vision that could then help to highlight and educate things that the Biden administration has done well. I also think that if Biden wants to continue to lean into his Trump is bad, vote for me, democracy's failing kind of message, the climate aspect should be in that conversation, right? So, like, there was some number crunching that was done recently, I think by Carbon Brief, where basically if they were calculated that if Trump gets reelected, we're going to see 4 billion tons of U.S. emissions by 2030. So that's basically like eradicating twice over all the work that we've done so far with rolling out renewables, addressing emissions, clean tech that we've done over the past 5 years. Not only is it a major undoing of all of the progress that the U.S. has made and has become more, you know, taking more global leadership, but then it's also going to add a tremendous amount of emissions because Trump is promising, right, to build, to dig, right, and drill.
Well, I want to push back a little bit.
Okay.
Because I think that one thing that is going on here is that I think that climate policy is being made to look more partisan than it is.
Yeah.
And part of that is that, right, that like both political parties in the U.S. are getting pushed to the extremes. But I guess my pushback is that I think that Democrats are an equal part of that problem by sort of taking climate change as like, it's a Dem issue.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
Like, oh, no, this is our issue. This is the one we care about. We're like, there's increasingly bipartisan concern over climate change. We might not agree on what we ought to do about it. There's going to be a lot of different approaches to addressing it, and there might be different paths forward, and there might be many paths that get us towards progress on climate change. But I think the more that Dems say, "Oh no, this is our issue. This is the issue we're good on," the more we're making it a partisan issue, and we're disincentivizing Republicans from crossing the aisle and voting on things like the IRA and proposing climate legislation and supporting green energy.
Yeah. Biden's well positioned to actually take up your suggestion because he has been still trying to sell himself as like doing as much bipartisanship as possible. You know, the financing and all the ridiculously extremely conservative gifts we gave to just get the House to sign on the, to keep the government open. Like that was like a clear, that wasn't even just a reaching across the aisle from Biden. That was like, let me give you a bunch of wins and I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
Right. So there is a place in which like the climate thing is, I think, really well positioned to your point, Alex, to actually be like, this is an opportunity where everyone benefits.
Yeah.
Right. It's not a zero sum game between blue and red team.
Yeah.
And it's wild to me why he wouldn't take up your suggestion, right, to like present that as a bridge. I think the point I was making about the the sort of oppositional element, or the Dems are the climate party and Republicans are not, is merely because Trump's the head of the ticket.
Sure.
And so Republicans are all in on the Trump thing, they're going to have to be the non-climate party, which is unlike politics in other democracies, right? Like in Europe, the climate politics don't cut easily on this right-left cleavage or this hyper-polarization like we see on the States.
Yeah.
And I actually don't think it would be in the States if we didn't have this kind of old school form of climate polarization that honestly feels like something that's 20 years old.
I think it is. It is on the ground. It's just not with the politicians, right? Like if you talk to, like, so I live in a red state, and like, I know a lot of very conservative Republicans, and I don't know if I know anyone who like doesn't believe in climate change.
Yeah.
I know people that disagree across the spectrum on what we should do about it.
Exactly.
And I know people who still think that we should be taking as much oil out of the ground as we can. But like the sense I get from the community is that the prescription is what's contentious, not the facts.
Yeah.
You can't really deny that the climate is changing with the amount of evidence we currently have, and you still have Republicans at the top doing that. And then the disagreement about what we should do about it, the conversation I hear still really mirrors it as different ways of addressing the same problem.
Yeah.
And there's arguments that I think are hugely flawed, like, well, we should be the ones to take the oil out because we'll do a better job, we'll create less pollution, or we'll speed up the development of renewables, or, you know, whatever it is. You hear a lot of arguments that I take issue with, but it's, I actually think more often those are good faith arguments than the left likes to give credit. Like we like to assume those are all bad faith arguments from folks who don't really think climate change is a problem and just want to avoid it. And there are many of those bad faith actors too, but there are a lot of good faith actors that really do just disagree about the prescription. I care about climate change for a lot of reasons. Several of those reasons are very conservative reasons.
Yeah.
Climate change represents the biggest market failure that the world has ever seen. Climate change is going to be like exorbitantly expensive in the long run.
Yes.
Right? Those are very conservative reasons to care about this.
So it is strange to me why then it's not, I mean, to Cody's original question, like not playing a more prominent role. And my only kind of armchair explanation for that is because of this like hyper-nationalization of the politics, it has to be an engaging with Trump as opposed to engaging with the communities in these red communities that are facing climate crisis and that are benefiting from climate, like already benefiting from climate policy, already seeing jobs, already seeing investments in their communities.
Okay, we've got a couple of minutes and I want to get one more story in. I want your thought in like a minute or two, Seema.
Oy vey, Cody.
So on a much lighter note, I want to talk about Dune 2, the closest movie that I've seen to like original Star Wars in quality and aesthetic. Passed a billion dollars in box office sales. We love consumerism here on the pod. So this isn't exactly a climate win in itself, but I wanted to get your thoughts because this movie making $1 billion plus means that people clearly have an appetite for learning about the dangers of resource exploitation and fascism.
Or do they just like Zendaya? Sorry, keep going.
Right. Are stories like this powerful, or is it, you know, just the ever inexplicable pull of Timothy Chalamet?
Alex, you go first on it.
I have my 1 minute take. My 1 minute take is I haven't seen Dune 2 yet. Loved Dune 1. Really looking forward to seeing it. I think there's a huge problem with these stories. And it's that they're all hero narratives. None of these stories are stories of organic cooperation, collaboration, and community work. They're stories of the chosen one that rises to save everybody. And I think the more we're taught that we have to wait for Superman or Timothy Chalamet or whoever it is, the more we disempower ourselves to do the many things that we can do in our communities to move ahead today. There's my 1 minute take. Seema, all you.
Bam.
I have a 3 second take.
What's your 3 second?
Dune 3, power to the people? Question mark.
yeah. So big fan of the book. Mixed feelings. Have seen on the movies. Denny did try to push back to some extent on the hero arc because he's also reading into the fact that originally, right, like Paul Atreides is not supposed to actually be understood as a hero. But there's also mixed questions, because if you actually read the original text, like, it's not really sure that he was grappling with the anti-hero adherence of Paul. But I just want to say a couple of points. 100% agree with you, Alex, that I am increasingly worried about superhero narratives, and also the weird fetishization of Marvel is a kind of like interesting, or that I guess the prevalence of Marvel is an interesting take of that we're all waiting around for people to save us, and many of those people are doing it in like very anti-democratic ways, or use the power of the state or go above state power. But when it comes to Dune, something that I am hopefully encouraged by is that that has such a huge fan base. There's maybe a whole new generation of people that are reinvigorated by the story, maybe through the movies, and are then inspired to go back to that novel, which is credited as being the kind of one of the first ecological, right, science fiction texts, or maybe cited as the first cli-fi text. And what I hope it at least does, here's my 30-second take, is get people to talk about the power of story and the power of narrative. And to your point, Alex, like, what questions about how we ought to be thinking about telling these stories when it comes to such things as the rise of fascism or ecological collapse, and whose stories are being told? And I think at the very least, both maybe regarding how you like the movie or liking the book and this and that, people at least start to debate about that. And I think that there's a lot of really interesting stuff that I hope we're going to get to dig into future episodes about the power of fiction itself and whether or not it's the best mechanism to kind of get at these kinds of meetings. But I do think there's a lot of power in art and narrative. So at the very least, I'm stoked that the movies are maybe jumpstarting that conversation.
Agreed.
Thanks so much for listening to A Hostile Climate. The show is hosted by me, Simona Capizani, and Alex Lee. Our show is produced and edited by Cody Nelson. Our theme music is by Mark Shapiro, and our show art is by Jean Julien. A Hostile Climate is an independently produced podcast, and we count on listeners like you to help us keep making more episodes. If you'd like to donate to support the show, you can find information on our website, ahostileclimate.org. And please make sure you're subscribed on any or all of your podcast platforms of choice. If you like what you hear, leave us a 5-star rating. Tell a friend. It really helps us out. Thanks again. See you next time.